Okay, Raboisai, this is very exciting. We are starting a new mini-series, and it's going to cover the 14th chapter of the original Maamar Basi Lagani, which was the Maamar released in honor of the previous Rebbe's Yom HaYilula, the Yahrzeit. Only it was released before he passed for the Yahrzeit of his grandmother, but ultimately we see it as the Maamar of the Hilula. And we are going to study one of the Rebbe's Maamarim. And together, this is going to be a five-part series. So before I begin, I just want to say a little brief thing about Basi Lagani, about Chassidus, and about Yud Shvat, just very briefly. Actually, I'll say four things. The first thing is, there's a lot of background. A background on Yud Shvat, and on Chassidus, and on Maamarim, and on Hilula. All of these subjects are very, very richly elucidated in a variety of different places on the web, including my own YouTube channel and website. I've spoken about Hilula, and there have been multiple series on Basi Lagani. There's a video that I posted from a couple of years ago, why it had to be a Maamar, all about the idea of a Maamar. So I don't want to repeat myself, and it's available. So if you want to, you know, research more and understand more, I encourage you to go to those places and watch, listen, and learn. I'm just going to recap some basic matters of fact. A Maamar is a Hasidic, formal Hasidic discourse, and only a Rebbe says a Maamar. So whilst the Rebbe spoke many Sichas, which are more casual talks, even though some of them are extremely profound and extremely deep and not simple to understand at all, there's something unique about a Maamar. And Hasidim were desperate for the Rebbe to formally accept the mantle of leadership. And until the Yahrzeit, the first Yahrzeit, or the first Hilula, which was a full year later, when the Rebbe actually delivered his first Maamar, so like there wasn't an acknowledgement. Many people regarded the Rebbe as a Rebbe, but it wasn't acknowledgement until he said a Maamar. And that was the Rebbe's way of formally accepting and acknowledging. You have a question? Maamar literally means like a saying or a statement. That's literally what it means. It's very different than a speech. Let's just say that when a Rebbe says a Maamar, he's in a deep meditative state, a deep state of cleaving to divine energy in a very serious way.
It has to be a copy of it, right? Written.
So the Rabbeim, the Rebbes of Chabad, delivered Maamarim, all of them delivered many, many hundreds of thousands of Maamarim. The Alter Rebbe never wrote his own Maamarim. There are like literally a precious few Maamarim that he actually wrote himself. He didn't write Maamarim. The Maamarim were written by Hasidim, including some written by his children and some written by his outstanding disciples. From that point and afterwards, the Rabbeim would write and orally deliver their Maamarim. Our Rebbe did not write his Maamarim. A Rebbe would deliver the Maamarim orally, and they were written, and there were rare occasions that the Rebbe would edit the Maamar. And an edited Maamar is very different than a non-edited Maamar. In the early years, it was a rarity for the Rebbe to edit the Maamar, and in the last couple of years, before the Histalkos, the Rebbe edited many, many Maamarim. And when it's an edited Maamar, then you know it's not just something somebody heard or thought that they heard, but you know that it's 100% accurate. And the Rebbe would go over this very, very carefully. Anyway, I could talk about Maamarim and Chassidus all night. I just wanted to say we're learning something kind of different. And a Maamar of Chassidus is unique to Chabad Chassidus. And I want to talk about Yud Shvat. So Hilula of a Tzaddik is a very special event. And on the day when a Tzaddik's passing is observed, there's an impact that's reverberates on a global level, especially if the tzaddik had a global reach. And in the simple words of the Zohar, as they are articulated and elucidated by the Alter Rebbe himself in Igeres HaKedesh in Tanya, when a tzaddik passes, so the tzaddik is elevated, the neshama is elevated. The neshama goes into an atmospheric kind of state. So the holiness of the tzaddik's neshama isn't limited only to terrestrial reality, but rather it expands in a way which is it's a very like a broad kind of influence. It's like a person could influence you by talking to you, by having a face-to-face interaction with you. And then there could be an influence that one might feel by being in the room with a person who is extraordinarily charismatic. And just being present, just being in the room, would have an influence on everybody. The first influence is what we call a way, a pneumistic way. It's a direct, it's a revelatory way. It's because of what you heard and because of what you observed or absorbed in a very personal way. And the other is what we would call atmospheric. And the latter is loftier. It's much more intense. It can be much more powerful, like a conversation that people can have. They can have conversations and forget conversations. But if somebody's at a majorly dramatic event, that's the kind of thing that lingers on. You know, think about the idea of hakel, the concept of bringing all the people together. So that's called Ur HaSoviv. That's called in Hasidic lexicon, that's called atmospheric or all-encompassing kind of energy. And the Tzaddik's Neshama moves into that higher level, which is called histalkos or histalik. And every year on the Hilula of the Yartzeit of the Tzaddik, so the Tzaddik is elevated yet to a higher madrega, to a higher level, as really is every Yid, which is why we say Kaddish on a Yartzeit, because a Yartzeit means that it's almost like there's a passing happening all over again, just like a person passes from this world into a higher world. So on the anniversary of the passing, they go to the next world, and that's where we have to say Kaddish, because just as there is an adjustment period, which is uncomfortable for the neshama, and it takes 11 months until the neshama finds solace and peace and gets used to his new habitat, and that's when Kaddish doesn't have to be said anymore. But on the Yartzeit, there's a major shift, but it's not such a major adjustment. It doesn't take 11 months. It's a day of discomfort. So, you know, it's like shifting to the next grade, new teachers, new environment, new subject material. It's a little bit uncomfortable, but it's much less of an adjustment from our terrestrial world to the heavenly realm. From realm to realm in heaven is much less of an adjustment. So when a tzaddik has that elevation, then all of the people that the tzaddik had influence on, or that the tzaddik had influence on through people that the tzaddik influenced, are also elevated. So therefore the community in a global sense that's inspired by the teachings of Chassidus and by the ideas and ideals that the Rebbe embodied and imparted necessarily will be elevated along with the tzaddik at the hilul of the tzaddik. So Yud Shvat is the Yartzeit of the previous Rebbe, the Rebbe's Rebbe, and the Rebbe observed it very much like that. But for us as Chassidim, Yud Shvat was very special because it was, in fact, the first time that the Rebbe said or delivered a maimer, thereby signaling that he finally, I use a word very loosely, capitulated or gave in to the incessant pleading of the Chassidim that he assumed that role. And from the moment that he assumed the role, the Rebbe changed entirely. You're talking about a person who, I'm using very, like, almost crass language now, but I'm using this language to help us understand something which is really beyond our language. You're talking about a person who was inherently a shy introvert who forced himself to change overnight. And from the moment that he dedicated himself to this task, he ceased to exist as a private individual. From that moment, there was never a vacation, there was never a personal life, there was nothing but the communal responsibility in a provincial, in a national, and really even in a global way. And it's just, you look at the Rebbe's life, it's an extraordinary, astounding kind of thing. There's more than four decades, there was not a moment, not a personal moment. It was like entirely devoted to Klal Yisrael. He worked all day and he worked all night. I mean, like, he barely slept. Three nights a week. He was available to everybody and anybody for almost 35 years, continuously. They would leave the office oftentimes at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning and be back at 9 the next day. And this went on for decades. Decades. I mean, like, it just was extraordinary. And he was a lot to say about that. So how do we experience these things? How do we experience a Hilula, and how do we experience the anniversary of Ascension, the Nekabos and Asiyas of the Rebbe? How do we experience these things? How do we make them meaningful? And the answer, if you're a Chabad Chassid, is through learning Torah. Because Chabad Chassid believes, and in a sense teaches, that everything has to come through the variable and convention of Torah. Everything comes through Torah. The Rebbe imparts his inspiration by virtue of the Torah he teaches. We connect to the Rebbe by virtue of the Torah we study. My brother's father-in-law, Rabbi Shmuel Lu, once asked the Rebbe, how could he be more connected to the Rebbe? He wants to feel more connected, be more connected. So the Rebbe said, so you should learn. You should learn Torah. So he said, what should I learn? He said, learn what I learned. So he said to the Rebbe, what does the Rebbe learn? The Rebbe said, Niglu Chassidus, the revealed area of Torah and the esoteric area of Torah. And we know that the Rebbe's primary focus, despite his extraordinary workload and responsibility, was learning Torah. After the Rebbe's heart attack, and that's a story in and of itself. So at some point, the Rebbe's doctor, his cardiologist, needed to hear his schedule so that he could prescribe for him kind of a schedule that would be healthy. So the Rebbe said he's not going to tell him the schedule. He doesn't tell anybody his schedule. But the doctor said, I need to know the schedule. So the Rebbe swore him to secrecy, and he spoke about this publicly. He said, I can never, ever tell anybody what the Rebbe told me, because the Rebbe said, I'm not allowed to say. But he said, here's the one thing I can tell you, that the vast majority of his time was spent studying Torah. Now, how the Rebbe answered so many letters, there are more than 30 volumes of letters that are printed to date, and they're not all printed yet. And how the Rebbe taught so much Torah, and how the Rebbe counseled so many people in so many different ways, and yet his primary focus was learning Torah, I don't have the answer to that question. I can't explain it. The whole thing is beyond us. But in order for us to connect to the spirit of Yud Shvat, in order for us to experience this as Hasidim should, it comes through Torah. And that's why I suspended my regular classes now for this week, and we're going to focus on the Maamarim of Basi Ligani. Now, when the previous Rebbe, before he passed, he had prepared Maamarim to be printed over the course of the next few months. This was a Maamar that had initially been delivered in the early 30s. The Friedrich Rebbe rewrote parts of the Maamar. He was not able to speak anymore at that point. He was a very sick man, very, very sick. And he had suffered multiple strokes and many other terrible conditions, but nonetheless, he was still writing, and it was a tremendous output of Torah, despite the fact that he had all of these impediments. So the Maamar was released for Yud Shvat, and then for Yud Gimel Shvat, for his grandmother's yahrzeit, for his mother's yahrzeit, and then afterwards, in honor of his father's yahrzeit, and in honor of Purim, there was a number that were printed. And in total, the original Basi Ligani has 20 chapters. And each year, the Rebbe would elucidate or illuminate another one of those chapters. And this went on from 1951 till 1970. And then the question was, nobody knew what happens now. And the Rebbe started over from the beginning again. And once again, 1971, he went back to the first chapter, delivered a maamar in the first chapter. So what we do is, what Hasidim have been wont to do, is to study one chapter of that 20 chapter maamar, the original kind of Hilula Magnum Opus of the, you know, the Friedrich Rebbe's farewell maamar, or as some refer to it as the last will and testament. And the Rebbe delivered multiple, at least two, but sometimes more than two maamarim, which are based on that chapter. We are going to study in this little series this year, My Name is Light. We are going to study the maamar that the Rebbe delivered in 1984. It's nothing to do with Orson Welles, I'm just saying. Or George, not... George, or George Orwell, what's his name? Yeah, nothing to do with that. Huh? Nothing to do with that. Nothing to do with that. This is in fact the second time around for that 14th chapter. Now, there are actually three maamarim that the Rebbe delivered. In 1964, which is the first time around, there was a maamar on Shabbos and a maamar on Matzoy Shabbos. Maamar on Shabbat Yod Shvat, and then after Shabbos, it was a separate maamar. And then in 1984, in Tavshin Mem Dalad, 5744, there was one maamar that was delivered. But it only makes sense that in order, before we learn that maamar, that we should learn the 14th chapter. So that's why I made you photocopies. And we are going to learn the 14th chapter of the maamar together. And after we learn the 14th chapter, we will have laid the foundation for understanding the maamar that we'll go to, that was delivered by the Rebbe in 1984. Okay? We're good? All right. Somebody said, I can't give more than an hour shiur. They can't listen for more than an hour. Okay, so my hour's starting now. Because till now, was just as Michal David sent me a message today. He says, I know, this is not going to be a regular class. I know you're going to give like a whole Fabrengen. Now you're going to be like a, it's going to be like a... I said, no, I'm going to try to teach. He says, yeah, I know you're going to talk about this. Okay, fine. So Fabrengening about the Mimer is over, and now we're going to learn the Mimer. And we'll Fabreng a little bit, maybe, in all of these five parts, but let's get serious. V'hine. B'chol zeh, despite everything that we've learned, v'ata mechaye es kulam ksiv. Here the previous Rebbe quotes a verse that's found in the ninth chapter of the prophecies of the book of Nehemiah. And he says, despite it all, you make everything animated. You make everything exist or live. So what's the B'chol zeh? The truth be told, you need to go back to last year's series, Beneath the Darkness, and you'll understand why it's the B'chol zeh. Because in the previous chapter, he talked about concealment, extraordinary levels of divine concealment that allow for all kinds of inappropriateness. And why God creates such concealment, such utter concealment, and so many challenges, and how he covers his tracks so well. So it's almost like you can't see God's presence at all. And now the Friedrich Rebbe kind of comes back to that. He says, B'chol zeh, or B'chol zeis, v'ata mechaye es kulam. So yes, he conceals himself. At the same time, it is God himself who gives vitality and sustains all of existence. And I want to stop for a moment and just highlight something about Chassidus Chabad. There are many Torah truths that people don't really understand, but they're able to accept. The point of Chassidus Chabad is to be able to understand it in a much more profound way. So, for example, a nursery child knows that Hashem is everywhere. Ask a child. He said, yeah, sure. He learned it in school. He learned the song. Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere. Up, up, down, up. Ask him, I'll tell you. He learned it in school. He knows Hashem is everywhere. Is he wrong? No, he's not wrong. Hashem is everywhere. Hashem is up, up. Hashem is down, down. Hashem is right, left, and all around. Yeah. What does that even mean? How do we actually understand that? And that's where Chassidus Chabad says we need to understand that. You can't just say the words, can't just accept it broadly speaking, but that things that can be understood have to be understood so that the area where you need faith for, you should use faith for. Don't use faith where rhyme and reason work. Use faith where rhyme and reason don't work. And because here rhyme and reason is able to work, but we can have a rational understanding of this. So as such, we have to try to understand it. And there are, of course, many levels. You know, a lot of people can learn the same Mimer and walk away with a different level of understanding. I'm not embarrassed to tell you that I myself have been working on understanding this chapter of the Mimer for better than a week, more than a week already. And I went over it many, many times and discussed it with a lot of people. And I think I have a pretty decent understanding of it finally. And I'm going to understand it even better when I'm finished teaching it to you. a tiny little metaphor for the point that I'm making, and I've shared this with you before, but I'm going to share it again just for brevity's sake, because the point is relevant now. If I have a Play-Doh in my hand, or slime, whatever it is, if I throw it at the wall, what's going to happen? It's going to splatter. That's going to splatter. It'll stick. It'll splatter. In what shape will it splatter? How will it splatter? Let me clarify my question. Can you predict with certainty how it's going to splatter? It's like you throw it 1,000 times and each time will be a little different. Right? But it's the same person, same distance, seemingly the same velocity, but it's not really predictable.
The name for this is called the Heisenberg Principle of Uncertainty. Why can't you predict it? Because Newtonian physics says that you can predict everything. And Heisenberg figured out that actually, no, that's not accurate. You can't predict everything. Because with the advent of nuclear physics, physics started to be understood in a whole different way. Quantum mechanics. So once you get into quantum mechanics, all of a sudden physics is not fit. Newtonian physics is totally outdated. So in Newton's view, we could have, in theory, the ability to predict everything. We just needed data. If you had enough data, you could predict everything. And that's called the principle of determinism. Newtonian determinism means we can tell you exactly what's going to happen. We're just lacking data. There's trillions of pieces of data. But in theory, if you could build a big enough computer and have enough RAM or whatever else is needed, in theory, we should be able to predict exactly how things are going to go. So based on the work of Niels Bohr, Heisenberg figured out that that's actually not the case. Why? Because Niels Bohr has figured out that the nuclei, which is at the essence, every atom has a nuclei, everything revolves around the nuclei. That's what's called, in the language of Kabbalah, it's called Nekuda Behechala. Hechala means there's a mass, but the mass revolves around the pinnacle, the core essence, the core. So that core, which it's amazing that it's talked about in Kabbalah. The Zohar talks about this, but it's exactly the language of nuclear physics. That core is at the center of everything. It's kind of the linchpin. Everything revolves around it. And the thing is this, that the nuclei is not stationary. The nuclei is in a state of flux. And when you add velocity to the mix, it's impossible to predict where the nuclei will go. And because it's impossible to predict where the nuclei will go, what will happen is that the quantum physics is going to shift because of the nuclei shifting. But that's impossible to predict. Thus, we find ourselves introduced to the Heisenberg principle of uncertainty. Because Newtonian certainty has been made uncertain, rendered uncertain with the advent of quantum mechanics. So I just explained to you why. I'm sorry?
I'm not sure.
You're not sure about that. Very good. Touché. So let me make this simple now. So before I started this whole quantum physics conversation, did we know how it's going to splatter on the wall? No. And after we had this whole conversation, do we know how it's going to splatter on the wall? No. So what did we accomplish with this?
Oh, they did a test in a vacuum. They put a hole and then they threw the...
Yeah.
Every
time is different because then when you introduce velocity into quantum physics, so the nuclei is always in a state of flux. It's impossible. Yeah, and they did many tests on it.
Yeah,
and it's impossible to predict. It, by the way, in theory, the Heisenberg principle of uncertainty is not really absolute. If we would be able to predict where the nuclei would go, if we could ever figure that out, then all of a sudden we would undo the uncertainty. But at present, with our present ability of measuring and ascertaining the quantum reality, it's impossible. So it becomes uncertainty. My point is this. The child knows that every time he throws it at the wall, it's going to be different. And the scientifically inclined, educated adult knows the same thing. Do they know they have the same end result? One understands it and one doesn't. So a person said, well, what's the point? Why do you have to learn about quantum physics? You ended up with the same bottom line anyway. Yeah, but now I understand it. And when you have an understanding of it, it's a whole different knowledge. So the same is true. Yeah, the child could sing a song. He could sing, Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly. Is the child right? Of course, child's right. Hashem is everywhere. What does that even mean? Ah, funny you should ask that question. Okay. So now the pasuk says, "Vata machayas kulam." God gives vitality, gives life, gives energy. So despite the fact that it, as it were, God conceals himself to the point that it seems he's not there, and many people say, "Where is God?" Despite the fact, Hashem also is at the same time, at the very same time of this absolute concealment, God is engaged with every iota of our existence. And the Friedrich Rebbe wrote like this: the ha'oras oir eleki, the radiation. I'm using that term loosely, of the divine light. And of course, that's all the euphemism. God is not a photon, but that's the euphemism that we use. That's language that it's the best we have, because the most spiritual things is photons. You can't put them in a box. You can't walk away with them. It's it's always in a state of flux. It's always moving, right? It's a kind of like ethereal. So the ha'ara of Eir Eliki, hari nimshach lahavois ulahachies es kol hanivroyim me'ayin liyesh. It's drawn forth. It actuates in order lahavois. Lahavois means to bring into existence. And lahachies means to continue to give it vitality. By the way, if anybody has real questions, that's fine. So I don't see questions. Shalom to everybody. I don't know why Devin says none of these channels ever interact with chat. Yes, I do interact, but you have to ask. I mean, if David is making funny comments about my singing, yeshar koyach, but that's not really a question. And thank you, Kevin, for the kind words. Devin, if you have a real question about the subject that we're talking about, I am going to try to look and respond. Shukriah. Okay. So, Hashem is creating everything, what we call ex nihilo, which is a Latin terminology for something from nothing, because before quantum physics, what was there? There has to be a moment where reality gets introduced. We don't have the ability to fathom. Huh?
What is the name? What are you saying?
Ex nihilo. That's what it's called. That's the Latin term for something from nothing, bringing something out of nothing. So that's lahavois. The word hava, lahavois, means like from the term havia, to be, also known as to be or not to be. I'm just kidding. So the idea of lahavois, ulahachies, and to give vitality, eskola nevroyim, all of the created reality, all of created existence, me'ayin liyesh ex nihilo, from, euphemistically speaking, nothing to something. We call something quantum physics, the physical reality, and then it all comes from a non-quantum physical reality, but can't fathom that. We can't imagine being what it means like when there's no quantum physics. We can only think within the term of some kind of physics, but something had to create physics. Okay, the Isa Be'igeres HaKedesh, the Friedrich Rebbe begins now to qualify the statement that he just made. The first statement he makes is, the first qualification is, that this is actually the intention of what the Alter Rebbe means in the fourth section of Tanya, which is called the Igeres HaKedesh, the holy letters or epistles of the Alter Rebbe, in Simin Chof, in chapter 20, that over there it says, the Ha'ara, a reflection of a reflection of a reflection, the radiance of the radiance of the radiance. Euphemism, euphemism, euphemism. Who bechol hanivroyim is found in all of creation, v'noitzrim v'nasim, and they are all formed and they are all made. Now, what the Alter Rebbe speaks about in Tanya is he speaks about what's called the Oir HaKav. So in the earliest writings of Kabbalah, like the Sefer HaBoyer opens with this idea, and it's of course referenced many, many times in the Zohar. In the beginning, there is God fills everything. Godliness fills everything. It is not possible for something to feel independent of God, to exist outside of God. So there can be no world, because the nature of a world is that I have to be. So there can't be anything. There can only be godliness. So with God, euphemistically, proverbially, metaphorically, parabolically, and then another few words does, is he creates this empty space, this mokim cholol. Now, the makim cholol is never really empty, because nothing can ever be really emptied of godliness. Godliness is always is everywhere, but it's in our eyes, in the eyes of nivroim, in the eyes of creations, we feel as if God's presence does not fill or pervade this reality. So that's the first requisite for us to exist independent of God, or to feel separate from God. And then it says that God brings into that makim cholol a kav, a thin line of light. And the thin line of light then gets thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner, and that's called the concept of tzimtzum, of God diminishing the light. And you keep diminishing the light so that each reality should be able to exist. Think of the outdoor theaters. You could never see the screen at midday. But at midnight, all the drive-ins were full back in the 60s. Why? Because the light that was projected onto The big white wall couldn't be seen because there was too much light. It was eclipsed by the light. It needed the sun to set. It needed night to fall. And the darker night was, the clearer the picture would be. So in order for us to be, so to speak, the less God, the more us. Which world or which reality feels entirely independent of God? Only our world. That's the meaning of our world is the lowest. The lowest means the darkest. Well, we don't feel, we don't know of even a glimmer of light. Atheism can only prosper in this world. There are no atheists in heaven. Also not in the foxholes, but for sure not in heaven. Why? Because they sense the presence of God. So these worlds are known as the world of Atzilus. That's a Kabbalistic term. World of Bria. Atzilus is hardly, it's not really a creation unto itself. It's like the light, or what they call in academia, effulgence, that comes from a source of light. It's never really separated from its source. So turn the lights off here. The light that is coming out of the light bulb right now in the ceiling, the light that's here will disappear within nanoseconds when the lights go off. Why? Because the light that's here is never really separated from a source. The photons are always continuously fed by the source. And the moment the lights are off, that's it, the light is gone. And you can't like box this light and save it for a dark day. It doesn't work like that. That's the difference between what we call Ur and Shefa. In Hasidus, we have this conversation, the difference between photons and between everything else. Everything else can be spatial, can occupy a space. Even mist or gas can occupy a certain space. And you can bottle it, but not so with photons. So that's like the world of Atzilus. It's like independent, but not really independent. And then from Atzilus, we go to Bria, where there's something that actually senses independence. Bria, it's to be or not to be? To be. Atzilus says not to be. But here he says, yeah, to be. What kind of to be? What are you? It's a to be. It doesn't have any form yet. It's like a person who has an idea and doesn't even know what the idea is yet. And then it gets fleshed in, and it has a form. But the form is not so crass, it's not so physical. For example, when you look at an item, whether it's a sculpture or whether it's a flatware, whatever it is, you don't identify it by virtue of its mass or its weight. You identify it by virtue of its shape. But it's not really the shape. It has a purpose. How do you hold a purpose? It has form. How do you hold form? Like, you need matter in order to have form, but ultimately form itself is not a physical thing. The form is outside. When you have matter, you can create form. But the form is not physical. So you could have a scissors, and you identify it as a scissors, and then somebody solders the scissors together, so all of a sudden it's not a scissors anymore. It becomes basically scrap metal.
Is it like selim?
Huh? It could be like a concept of selim, similar. Right? So that's the idea of a tzura. Tzura is form. So the world of Yetzirah is a world, it's a world of form, but it's not a world of physicality. And then we come to the world of physicality, which is called the world of Asiya. And even Asiya, there's Asiya Haruchni and then Asiya Hagashmi. So the Friedrich Rebbe starts like this. He says, all of existence is brought into existence and continually sustained by God Himself. Not by something else, by God Himself. Now, why do we see it? And the answer is it's a ha'ara, the ha'ara, the ha'ara. So it's a very faint glimmer. We don't see it. But it is a reflection of a reflection of a reflection, a glimmer of a glimmer of a glimmer of the original. And where is this? That's what it is. Where is it? It's even in the worlds of Nivroim, the world of Bria. It's even in the world of Yetzira. Nivroim is just like an amorphous is, an ism. It is, but it doesn't really know what it is. It doesn't have a specific form. It's not limited to a specific form. Tzura is it has a specific form attached to it. And then even in the world of Nasin, the world of action, in the world of Asiya. So God's presence is found in all these worlds. And that's what the Alter Rebbe speaks about in Tanya. He says the Oyer HaKav comes to us in two ways. One level of the Oyer HaKav comes in what's called a pnimius way, which means it matches and marries each level of existence that it brings into existence. And therefore, if it's a lower level of existence, it will have less divinity in it. There will be less and less and less divinity. That is true, Kevin. Fish never separates from water, and there's a certain something special about fish because of that. That's a good point. The fish didn't die in the marble, right? The fish were always connected to their source, and that's why the water represents purity, and there's something special about fish. Anyway, not directly related, but true. So, I'm just responding to comments. So, the Oyer HaKav, the way it relates to in a personal way, is something that has to engage with each level of creation, has to interface with each level of creation specifically. Then we have this concept that godliness or divinity is found in all levels of creation equally. It influences all levels of creation equally. And I will give you a simple example, going back to something I said before. Suppose you have a master communicator, a person of an exalted person who knows how to connect with people. He knows how to read people. He understands. It doesn't take him very long to figure people out. And he's able to craft a message that will very much speak to the person they're trying to speak to. So if he's trying to influence or uplift or inspire, he knows exactly how to touch each person. Who was the smartest of people? Shlomo HaMelech. And what do we see an embodiment of his genius? So we have this statement that he could speak 3,000 parables. Okay, so he was a creative storyteller. What's so wise about that? So Chassidus often emphasizes that the brilliance of Shlomo HaMelech was he could take a concept and he could relate it to 3,000 different levels. And each level, it would be perfectly calibrated for that individual to understand. He'd meet 3,000 people and he would say the same thing in 3,000 different ways, and each of those people understood it perfectly. The more you can communicate, the wider range that you can communicate, invariably the more talented communicator you are. So there are some people who are great with little kids, but that's all they're good with. They're great with little kids. They're not very effective with adolescents. They're not able to connect with grown-ups or even with elderly people. That's not their thing. And some people are fantastic with the elderly. They just have a way of communicating with the elderly, but they're not good with kids or adolescents. And then they could be a person with what we would call charisma, where a person who somehow has not only the external charisma, but also the brilliance to be able to communicate with each person, to understand each person, to empathize emotionally, and to understand intellectually what will stimulate, what will move that individual. He said, that is the most extraordinary of people. The Rebbe had an uncanny, extraordinary way of connecting with every person he met. Whether they were a head of state, a menial laborer, a child, an elderly person, and you have thousands of people walking by him, and he connected with each person. There's it's a beautiful little story. There's actually a video of it, my wife's great uncle was a chassid named Zalman Taibel, and he was a very emotional, hearty, kind of passionate person, and he didn't have any children, and towards the end of his life, he was suffering from Alzheimer's. And so they brought him to get a dollar from the Rebbe. And he had brought a niggun to Lubavitch called Ano Avdo de Kutcha Bricho. I am a servant of Hashem. And the Rebbe was not young at the time. He was almost 90 years old. He was standing on his feet for hours. Never took a coffee break. Never took a washing break. The whole thing was crazy. And this like not once, not twice. Every Sunday for years. And Zalman Taibel comes by and the Rebbe gives him a dollar. And the Rebbe immediately knows that he's not connecting. He's out to lunch. He doesn't know. So the Rebbe looks at him, and the Rebbe starts to sing, Ano, Ano, Avdo, Avdo, de Kudsho Berichu. And immediately there's a flicker of recognition in Zalman Taibel's eyes. It's not only the Rebbe's ability to connect to people, it's his sensitivity, his compassion, his concern for each person. Like, and he noticed that he wasn't connecting, and with music he was able to connect him in a very profound way. That's just a tiny example. And just stories of a child walks in the Rebbe, talk to this child. Like every single person. There's copies, guys. So this is what we call that personal kind of connection. Now imagine that there is a an event. An event. The king comes out, the queen comes out. There's an event, a massive event. And all of the people there are moved or excited. Sometimes this happens, you know, people go to see rock and roll royalty. You know, they go to a concert. And there's a very gifted performer. And everybody is like uplifted and moved by the performance. And people say, oh yeah, I know this performer. Yeah, yeah, I went to 10 concerts. I know this, some of these groupies, but they don't really know the person. They don't know him individually. They don't know, they never spent a moment in private conversation. But yet, that person is affecting all of these people in what we call an atmospheric way. Now, imagine, would that person, let's say this big artist, have the time to share his or her music with each of these people? Imagine that these people actually cared about people and they were not just there to make money, and there was an artist who wanted to make the world a better place, and he's with music trying to uplift and inspire and make people kinder and better. Imagine such a thing, right? So you can meet with people and you could share some music and touch with people, or he could sing one song or whatever is one performance, and in doing that, everybody could be uplifted, everybody could be moved in the same way. In the two examples, in the first one, the musician, let's say a person who is very initiated, is the greatest musician, very talented musician. So the person who's a musician appreciates the music differently than somebody who doesn't really appreciate music. And the musician is able to connect to that person because they have more in common, because they understand each other on a different kind of level. And then there could be people that it's more difficult. So how could such a person be connected to every person? It's not physically possible. So they would have, let's say, proteges and students. You have people who are inspired by the music of Bach or Beethoven, whatever these people. So the people who study their music, work on the music, they feel a connection because they're absorbing the message, but it's all distant. It's from a recipient of a recipient of a recipient. Do you know what I'm saying? It's not a. But if you're at the concert, then everybody is connecting in the same way, or at least everybody's there equally. Maybe they're not connecting the same way. The person who knows and understands music is connecting in a profounder way. The person who has less of an appreciation is not connecting in as meaningful a way, but everybody's there. It's the same performance for everybody. So the latter, says the Alter Rebbe, the latter is the Oir HaKav, the way it affects all of existence. So that Oir HaKav is found everywhere. It's not the Oir HaKav, the way it goes in a pneumistic way, affecting each level of creation. Each level of creation has a different understanding and knowledge and appreciation and awareness of its creator. But the Oir HaKav, that's called the Ha'ara, the Ha'ara, the Ha'ara. It's a very faint glimmer. But they're still getting the same thing, so to speak. What are they getting? The Kav itself, the light itself. And that's what this is about, by the way. I mean, we're going to really get you'll understand the name of the series, My Name is Light, when we get into the Maimer of Tav Shemem Daled in the 5744, but this is all about light. And the point is this, that the Oyer and the Chayes Aliki is Nimshir B'chol HaNevroim. Okay, so the Friedrich Rebbe made a statement here, and he qualified that statement, and he said, this is actually what the Alter Rebbe is talking about in Igeres Chof of Tanya, and he quotes a line out of that Igeres. Quotes a line out of that. And he says that the highest and the loftiest level of divinity is actually found everywhere. Okay. So now, the Friedrich Rebbe does something very interesting. He made a statement. He qualified. Now he says, truth be told, this is actually found or alluded to in a statement that our sages make in the Talmud. Our sages talked about mysticism in the Talmud? Well, not really, but listen to this. Shehu ha'oyer v'achayis aliki, that is the light, God himself. Shenimshir b'chol ha'nevroim. U'chemaymer, like a statement which is made in Masechet Avodah Zarah, and the statement is, hazonu mefarnes, he who sustains, who nourishes, mekarnei re'emim ad beitzei kinim. So what does that mean? What are karnei re'emim and what are beitzei kinim? So let's do first Karnei Re'emim. Karnei Re'emim, Rashi says, Chaya G'doyla, a very large animal. A very large animal. What does that mean? So actually, the first time we have a Re'em mentioned is in the Chumash itself. And we have in the blessings that Moshe Rabbeinu gave to the tribe of Yosef. And Yosef is a very special tribe. And Yosef had some very special descendants. First and foremost, Joshua, Yehoshua. He's from the children of Ephraim. So Yosef's blessing is Bechor Shoro Hadarlo. He says, glory is going to be given. Hadar, glory is going to be given to Bechor Shoro, to his preeminent descendant, his ox. Who is his ox? And why would it be nice to call somebody an ox? So he says, Vikarne Re'em Karnov. But he's given the horns of, we're going to translate it in the Kehat Chomesh, they translate it as an aurox. So Rashi asks a simple question. He said, one second, I don't understand. First you said he's an ox. Then you said he's an aurox. Which one is he? I'll talk about an aurox in a second. So Rashi says like this. He says, because Moshe Rabbeinu is talking about Yehoshua, Joshua, and he compares him to an ox and an aurox. Why does he stick to one metaphor? Obviously, he's not calling him an ox. He's trying to say something. So Rashi says, sure, koichi kosha, vein karnois of nois. The ox is a very strong animal. As the euphemism go, strong as an ox. Everybody says it, strong as an ox. The strong animal pulls the plow. I'm not talking about the wild animals, but the stronger pulls the plow, the ox, strongest of domesticated animals. Yehoshua has tremendous strength, powerful guy. But there's nothing beautiful about an ox, not a particularly beautiful animal. Ox is not attractive. His horns are not attractive. He doesn't come to some kind of, you know, glorious halo. He doesn't have this gorgeous headpiece. People, you go into these hunters' houses, they have these deer or reindeer mounted on the wall. Nobody mounts an ox. It's not strong as an ox. But he says, shor kosha, vein karn of nois. Avo re'em karn of nois, vein koiche kosha. His horns are very beautiful, very graceful horns, but he's not very powerful. And therefore, Rashi tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu gave the bracha to Yehoshua, that he should have kocho shel shor, he should be strong as an ox and graceful as the aurochs. What is the aurochs? I was actually curious. I never heard of an aurochs. And I don't remember seeing an aurochs. They live in Israel? Well, according to my friend Wikipedia, it's an extinct cattle species, considered to be the wild ancestor of modern domestic cattle. So if you say they live in Israel, A-U-R-O-C-H-S, aurochs. The picture I have here is a skeleton. But he has very nice horns. It's very nice horns. See, here's the aurochs. Here's a skeleton of the aurochs. According to Dr. Wikipedia, very nice horns, beautiful horns. But apparently it wasn't a very strong ox. I guess the proof in the pudding is he's not around anymore. I think he got hunted also. But anyway, the bottom line is there are no more auroxes. So that's the point then is this. The point is that the aurox, the focus is on the height of the aurox. So of all animals, not of wild animals, but all animals, the height of the aurox is so it's almost like talking about different creatures, different animals. You talk about the pinnacle, that's the re'im. That's the pinnacle. So the euphemism then is the mikarne re'im, from the horns of the aurox, that's the highest, the high point, down to the beitzei kinim. Now, beitzei kinim literally reads as the eggs of lice. But the thing is, it doesn't really mean the eggs of lice, because as Rashi tells us, and really, the Gemara says it in Masechet Shabbat. The Gemara is talking about things which are created through male, female organisms, or if they're born out of what he calls self-reproduction rather than sexual reproduction. So the Gemara says that the Gemara talks about Beitze Kinim. And the intimation is that we're talking here about louse, that before they emerge from their eggs, because you can have nesting, God forbid, if you get lice, you can have the louse, they first nest in your hair, and then the eggs break, and then we should never know. So it sounds like the Gemara, hear a scratch here. It sounds like the Gemara is talking about the eggs, but the Gemara ends up saying that it seems the Mikri, Minohu, it's a certain species The Mikri Beit Sekinim, the species itself is called the eggs. It's called the eggs of lice. They're called egg lice. That's in the language of the Gemara. And the way Rashi says it in Masechet Avodah Zarah, he says, Minahu. This is based on what the Gemara and Shabbos says on Daf Kuf Zayin. Minahu, it's a species. The Miskri, this species is called Beit Sekinim. The Dakenhein, they're very, very thin. They're very, very small. Very small. And he gives us a couple of French words. And he gives Aramaic word for it also. What's the point of the Gemara? So the Gemara over there in Maseches Avodah Zarah is discussing God's schedule, as it were. Obviously, it's a euphemism. So what is the day is divided up into four segments of 3 hours. What does God do in the first 3 hours? What did he do in the second 3 hours? And the Gemara says, and then in the Shlishius, in the third 3 hours, Yoshev Vizon et Kol Ha'olam, he proverbially sits and he nourishes, or he provides nourishment for the entire world. Mikarni de'emim ad beit sekinim. So whatever, I mean, you could read this Gemara in a very, very, like a parable, you know. But the Friedrich Rebbe is making a point there. He said, he's shining the light of Chassidus. He says, well, think about that. We're talking about God himself. We're talking about God's like engagement with the world, like God's schedule. So then who is making all this exist? God is making all this exist. He's not sending some ministering angel. He's not creating a hierarchy of eventually everything gets created. Yeah, God's the CEO. He's on top of everything. But he's got the, you know, billions of angels doing his job. And each angel reports to the angel higher. And everybody, a perfect reportage, and God can manage everybody. No, God himself is providing for everyone. And the Talmud uses the tallest of animals, from the aurochs' horns, down to the tiniest of lice. And the Friedrich Rebbe says, if you think about what we just learned, and then you frame it by that statement of the Gemara, say, ah, so that's what our sages were saying. Our sages, then, on a deeper level, are talking about the Oir HaKav, even though our sages didn't use that language in the Gemara. They used either legalese, very legal language of how you administer law, or they use parables and stories and figures of speech. So just look at figures of speech. You would never like understand this if you just read the Gemara. But when you learn Chassidus, and then you look at the Gemara, that's what the Gemara means. God himself is providing, and we have this range, metaphoric range, from the height of the aurochs down to the eggs of the lice. Okay, now he says, the Ha'or v'Hachayis Meir v'Nimshach Gam b'Madrega Yeset Achteinim, that the essence of divine light radiates even in the lowest of levels. Hayirse Shvelim, even in the lice. The lice exist because God makes them exist, God himself. And he says, U'Kumesh HaKosuf, this then would be the way we can understand the verse that's found in the book of Psalms, Psalm 139, verse 8, that it says, Im esak shomayim, if I could climb into the heavens, if I could search the heavens, shom oto, so God is there. Va'atziya she'el, if I could spread myself down into the lowest levels, hineko, there you are. Now, you read the verse of Tehillim, it's David HaMelech's spiritual poetry. It doesn't really say anything to you. It's spiritual poetry. God is everywhere. It sounds like Hashem is here, Hashem is there. It's not wrong. It's David HaMelech says it. Says it. But now the Friedrich Rebbe says, listen to everything we just learned. Think about the way he explained from a mystical Hasidic perspective, as he further articulates the words of the Alter Rebbe in Igeres HaKedesh. See then how you would frame it with the Gemara, and now understand the Gemara differently, and then you can even look into this poetic spiritual poetry of David HaMelech and say, aha, so that's what this is alluding to. So when we say that Emesek Shemayim Shomata Vatziya Sheelineka, this poetry from the 139th Psalm, it's actually a profound lesson. It's a teaching. It's not just poetry. It's not just, you know, see him in the heavens, see him in the depths. Spread yourself in the depths. No, that's what it means. So, but what does it mean, see him then? What does it mean, im esak? If that's what it's talking about, what did David HaMelech actually mean? What was he expecting of you? And here, the Friedrich Rebbe says something astounding. He says, you know what that means? Because if you look in the Radak and the Mitzudas, they say, Esak Shomayim Shomoto, if I could climb into the heavens, if I could fly to the highest of levels, which doesn't mean physical heavens, by the way, if I could be in the loftiest of consciousness, you'd find God. And if you could somehow lower yourself to the lowest base level of existence, you would discover God's presence. So he says what it means, and here something marvelous happens, because there's already like a transmission of an intellectual and cerebral academic concept is now already being synthesized and distilled into an emotional thing. What we're about to learn now is actually emotional. It's going to touch our heartstrings now. You're going to start to like play your heart like a harp. He says, do you know how you experience this? He says, "Dezeo hisbonus gedoyla." This is the great contemplation. I don't know why the Friedrich used the word hisbonus gedoyla. I don't know what that means, but I asked many people. I didn't get a satisfying answer. But anyway, it's a great contemplation. Begadlus havaya, and the greatness of God. Shenimshech b'chol seder shtalshos. That godliness is to be found everywhere, everywhere. So I see somebody named Darth wants to meditate on the 72 names of God. Darth, listen to this. He says that you should meditate and contemplate. Let's forget the names for a second, because that's like, it's like very mystical. He says, but you can look at Seder Ishtashos. You can look at the proverbial chain of descent of how one reality begets the next reality. You can understand this in a very literal way, like the food chain. You can see how there's ecology. Everything has a chain. One thing feeds into the next, and this is all a reflection of a deeper spiritual truth. Ad madregas habruyim hayoyser shvalim, until you get to the lowest level. Ubiyecheles kol adam va'adam, every single human being, every human being is created in God's image. It's a brain. Every human being, gam haposhet b'yoyser, the simplest of people can know this. You can look at the world that God created and marvel at God's creation. You could look under a microscope and you can analyze the variegation that is found within nuclear or quantum physics and be blown away at the range. Such a breadth, such range. It's incredible. Shiroya, Godless Havaya, you see the greatness of God. All of this is, by the way, being created, brought into existence, and nourished constantly by the same God. Not trillions, not gazillions. I don't even know what you call it. Infinite. If you talk about the universe, you talk about 60 million universes that they're able to count. I don't even know how you count that. 60 million universes. You talk about trillions of stars. And each of these things has microorganisms. Each of these things has within it a system within a system. Today you can look at the Milky Way, a picture from literally from outer space, from light years away. You can see a picture, and you could look at a picture of a cell, and it's like almost the same image. You could almost go crazy from things which are so massive, so enormous that it boggles the mind, down to the tiniest little microcosmic, quantum physics level things, and there's an intricate, exquisite structure in each of these things. And it's all the same God. And he's creating everything at every single moment, or bring all of this into existence. You understand? We're learning Chassidus. What does Chassidus do for us? It helps us to start to appreciate God. We learn Chassidus, it says, why do you have to learn Chassidus? You start to believe in Hashem differently. Well, I believe in Hashem. You don't even know what you believe in. You know the famous story, a fellow says he's an atheist. He says, really, you're an atheist? Tell me about your atheism. Oh, I don't believe God, this, that, that. And the chassid listens, says, I want to tell you a little secret. The God you don't believe in, I don't believe in either. That's not God. That's the old man sitting on the moon made of green cheese. That's not God. So when somebody contemplates all this, If you really take the time to just like look at things, look at the world. But by the way, Maimonides, the Rambam, says that how does a person come to appreciate Hashem and to start to love Hashem? By contemplating creation. He talks about the spiritual reality and he talks about the physical reality. So when a person comes to this contemplation, is bonanazu oisa his spoilers gedoyla benefesh. It blows your mind. It excites you. It inspires you. So, wow, It's like a wow thing. The wow factor. When you look at the world, it comes away a wow. I know I shared this before many years ago. We had we were working with the Weizmann Institute of Science. And it's a long story how I get involved with that. But anyway, they wanted to do an event, and the event was about genetic disorders that you know, how do you prevent research on the genetic disorders? And there was a family that had suffered, Nebuch, from a genetic disorder, or, you know, from chromosomes that would mix together. And they devoted their wealth to research, and Weizmann wanted to get their hands on that money. So, and one of the guys was coming to one of my classes, so they had this event at the Science Center, and they brought in one of the top Weizmann scientists, and he was talking about how a pregnancy is achieved. In plain English, it's like getting a hole-in-one. That's like the odds of a pregnancy ever being achieved. The odds of any of us ever being conceived is the odds of a hole-in-one. And somehow we're all here, along with another 7 billion of us. So that's the odds. And then he talked about like the things that happen within the first 10 seconds of, and the science have documented this, within seconds, and when there's a genetic disorder, where does it go wrong? So when could they intervene? How could they intervene? They're trying to come up with ways to intervene to maybe like in somehow to enrich the egg before it's fertilized. Crazy things. I mean, like, and I remember listening to this, and it was like the nuance and the detail. It was detail about the, you're talking about like microscopic quantum level things. It was like, I was just unbelievable. And the Eibishter creates all this. And the Eibishter breaks every one of us live. And I remember afterwards, I was the MC. I remember afterwards saying that I was wondering whether I would walk away, for it's a scientific event. I'll walk away questioning my faith. Questioning, because officially science and religion are not compatible according to many people's narrative, which is not true. It's actually a big false notion. But I said, I have to tell you, like, just sitting here for the last 2 hours and listening to all this, watching this presentation, has made me so much more grateful to Hashem and has blown my mind on the level of my faith in Hashem. And so this professor, was Nebuch, not such a big believer, comes over to me after. He like kind of pats me on the back, you know, like he's consoling me. He says, you know, you really don't have to believe in God anyway. You can believe in intelligent design. He's just telling me how they came up with the way. It's obvious that the world could not have brought itself by accident. There has to be some kind of massive intelligence. But don't worry, it doesn't mean you have to put on film. I'm shkoyach. Thank you very much. So now, when you see the glory of God, you have to find a way to protect yourself from that too. He said, yeah, it's taka amazing, and it couldn't be random, and it didn't happen by itself. But don't worry. You still don't have to. It's still not indicative of God. So basically, he found a different name for God. But the virtue was that he didn't have to obey him or listen to him because it has nothing to do with him. Well, okay, Nebuch. So, but the truth is that when a person has emuna and he looks at all these things, it's amazing. He gets pushed excited from it. The kolza, why is this? And here's an amazing Hasidic insight from the Friedrich Rebbe. The kolza, and why is all this? Like, why is the world so sophisticated? Why is there so many trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of interlocking details at every single second? And if one of those things would be off, everything would be shifted. Why? He says, "Kol zeh lefisha ha'oir hu ein soif be'etzem," because the light is inherently infinite. And because you're talking about light which is inherently infinite, it brings about a world which seems infinite. I mean, for our minds, the world is infinite. It's impossible to collate everything. It's literally impossible to pull it all together. So, al korchach, we're talking about an ein seif, gam ken lispashtusi. And here, the Friedrich Rebbe is saying a very, very interesting word. Sorry. V'kol zeh lefisha ha'oir hu ein seif be'etzem. And because the oir is infinite, the light is infinite, the effulgence is infinite, it's also infinite in the way it radiates and expresses itself. In other words, like this. In certain sfarim of Kabbalah, it says that God is infinite, but the light is the light of Ein Sof, the or of Ein Sof, but the light is not itself Ein Sof. But that doesn't really work because or is Me'in Hamor. The or is, the effulgence is an expression of the luminary, of the source itself. So Chassidus explains to us that it's not the or of the Ein Sof, it's or Ein Sof. That the light itself is, so to speak, infinite. Just like the solar rays are solar in nature. And the light that's radiated or reflected from the moon is lunar in nature. I mean, lunar is a bad example because it's just a reflection. But if you talk about the solar energy, it is solar. It's not something else. It's the same light as the sun. We're just further away from it. We're far enough away not to be burned up, and at the same time close enough not to freeze. And that's exactly like the Earth happened to land exactly where the two poles are too frozen to experience to live altogether, right? So far, and that the extreme, the widest section or the closest section to the sun is going to be barely able to live at the level of the equator. It's so hot, and then everywhere else, you know, varying levels of comfort. If Earth would be like a little more, one of the other, there would be a part of Earth which would be entirely uninhabitable and couldn't sustain life. Of course, that's an accident. Right? So he says, not only is the source infinite, but the light itself is invested with infinitude. Beribui hamadreges v'hishtalshlos, in endless levels, and hishtalshlos, that choreographed chain of development, of descent, ad lamata mata mamash. So this is like, up until this point, this is part one of the Ois. First part of the Ois. So we learned about God's presence, how God is actually making everything exist. Now the Friedrich Rebbe says, wherever that light goes, wherever the light is mispashet, it doesn't react. It is not phased. It doesn't change. It doesn't change. The Eine Kedimin HaNesham B'Guf. The Gemara says indeed, Ma HaNesham Malas HaGuf, Af HaKadosh Baruch Hu Malas HaElam. A person is alive, the Neshama is found in every part of his body. A dead person is going to be consumed by the vermin of the earth. A live person, even the furthest extremity like the heel, is not going to be chewed on by animals. Why? Because the soul is there. Because it radiates with life. So it says, just as the whole body radiates with the light of the neshama, and the whole body is equally alive, Hashem, so to speak, radiates within the world. It's true. It's true that we use that metaphor. But that metaphor only addresses one slender element of God's relationship with the world. Otherwise, then the light of God is not like the neshama and the guf. The neshama had a mispa elas mimikra guf. The neshama is moved, it's phased by the reality of the body. If the body, God forbid, is sick, then the neshama is not able to express itself. And of course, one neshama can't be in two bodies at the same time. So the neshama is limited to the body. But the light of God, do you offend the sun when you put the blinds down? I'll show that sun. I'm not letting that solar light into my house. No, of course not. And what happens if you play with the solar light? What happens if you put all kinds of funny colors into the solar light? Do you affect the sun? Of course not. And how many suns how many places could the sun shine at the same time? Like the Gemara famously says, and somebody asked Rabbi Yossi, how many shechinas are there? And Rabbi Yossi said to him, how many suns are there? You have many windows in your house. Oh, you need a sun for each window. So the shechinah is everywhere. The light of the sun is everywhere. The Hashem's being here is like the light of the sun that's here. It doesn't affect the light. It doesn't phase the light. So on one hand, we say it's like a neshama leguf. On the other hand, it's not a neshama leguf. That there could be any shinui in the oir, like the islapshos, is through what we call islapshos. Islapshos is best going to be termed embodiment. Like the body is like a garment for the soul. But it becomes embodied within the body. It's stuck within that frame. The fact that hislapshus, that this kind of embodiment can have some kind of difference, it's only bahachayas shebebechinas koyach. It's only the chayas on the level of koyach. So this is really explained in a mimer that was delivered by the Friedrich Rebbe's father, by the Rebbe Rashab, in the year Tafresh Samach Dalet, and it's a Rosh Hashanah Maimer, heralding the new year of Rosh Hashanah 1903. And over there, he asks some very interesting questions as to the way God is constantly renewing creation. So when he talks about God renewing creation, and he says, you know, why can't you get like a download that would last you like a battery for a day, for a week, for a month? Okay? And what's the difference between the Rosh Hashanah and every day or every moment? Every moment God is that's how he gets, how he opens the conversation. So he says that the Alter Rebbe uses very interesting terminology in the Shari Echad, one of the second section of the end of Tanya, Sefer Shobeinim, pardon me, in Likutei Amarim, that in chapter 51 and chapter 52, he uses two different words to describe the energy of God in animating the world. He uses the word koach, which means power, and he uses the word or, light. If I expend a lot of energy, if I expend energy on a particular subject, what happens to me? If I spend energy on something, I'll get exhausted, I'll get tired. Can I spend energy on two totally different things at the same time? Not really. Why? Because when you talk about koyach, talk about that it has to be malbush. It has to be embodied. Yeah? If that's where you're putting your koyach, then that's where your koyach is going to be. So a person could say, I'm talking to you, I'm intimately engaged with each and every, I know exactly what you, all of you at the same time. That's ridiculous. You can't do that. You can be engaged with a person at one time. You could move from different people. You could have a capacity to engage people, but you can't be engaged with multiple people at the same time. You can be engaged with a crowd. You're not engaged with individuals. That's koyach. Koyach means I'm invested into something. And when it's not a kefal lashon, he says, because from a perspective of koyach, of power, you can only do eini yochel ases beis dvarim. Why? Because you're nitfas b'hapula, because you're grasped, you're if you will, you're stuck in the concept of this action. You're within this action now. You can't get without this action now. And we know that when a person's invested in something, it makes a difference on him. If you do something, you have a project to do, and you invest yourself, and you put yourself into it, and until the point that you really, really like succeed at something, it could change you as a person. You are the person who did A, B, and C. That was one of the life-altering experiences you had. We've all had life-altering experiences. We've all had things which meant nothing to us, like they say, water off a duck's back. It depends how much you invested in it. If you invest in it, it modifies you. But all of that modification is only possible when we're at the level of koyach. However, when we're talking about it, because there's tfisa. Tfisa means it's grasped, so to speak. I'll look at the questions here. To the real AI, I'm talking to everybody. I think everybody could benefit from learning Chassidus. Chassidus is about God, and all of humankind is created in God's image, all of humankind. So everybody could benefit from this. We're talking about God's imminent presence. Which human being could not benefit from that? So this is the idea of koyach. And there is a level of koyach. There's a level in which God engages in the world in a koyach way. So God powers this or powers that. And it's the godly energy. It's invested in powering a specific detail of the world. So then it's the energy invested in that. Fire and water are not the same energy. But the Koir HaKav, the esoteric level of God's light, right? What we call the imminent level of God's light or the atmospheric level of God's energy, like the sun, again, it's just a euphemism, a metaphor, is everywhere equally. From the mountaintops down to the valleys, and there's no tefisa, there's no halbosha. So rak bebchinas shebchinas koyach v'yedua the chayes sheba bekoyach is bekelim debiya. So this is talking about what we talked about before. We talked about the world of atzilus, the world of like that's like subconsciousness, and then we have the world in which there's an idea, but I haven't really formulated the idea, and then the idea gets fleshed in, and it gets a form, and then I act on it. Different levels of the human experience. That's a metaphor of four different levels of divine creation of worlds. So when we talk about something called Kelim of Biyah, Keli means literally a vessel or a convention. If I want to tell somebody that I have a deep emotional connection with them, how would I do it? How could I express myself to somebody? I could do it through action, giving them a gift. Very good, Jake. So that gift, there's an action taken that demonstrates I care for them. You know what else I could do? I could interrupt something very important just because they need me. And then say, wow, I really count. There was a person, a prominent individual telling me, they say, extremely wealthy person, and he had this conversation once with one of his grandchildren, and he said, would you interrupt a conversation with the president of the bank for me? And he said, of course I would. And the grandchild didn't believe it. And then there was a story, and it was like a big loan and whatever, the president of the bank, he said, I got to take this call. And he took his grandchild's call, and he said, this child changed afterwards. Why? Because he said, my grandparent actually cares about me. So that's another way of saying it. How else could you say? People say things with music. People can compose a song. People can sing a song. People use words. You know, go to Hallmark. People spend hours and hours looking for the right Hallmark card, but it's somebody else's words. People could say the words, I love you. And they could be talking to a variety of different things. They could love their food. They could love their parents. They could love their children. They could love their spouse. They could love their friends. They could love all kinds of things. And the word love is verbalized by human beings millions and millions of times a day. And each one is slightly different. It's a keli. It's alphabet soup until you use it. It becomes a vehicle through which you're expressing something profound. So the kelim of biyah, that's bechinas metzias. That's where we start to find an independent existence, so to speak, of God, like we said in the Igeres HaKadosh earlier. Reishis hayesh, where you start to find something of independence of God. Go back to my metaphor earlier when the night falls and all of a sudden the picture is available in the drive-in, right? Because it's the absence of light that allows for that picture to radiate. Ein b'shum his spoil. So that's there, mishum zeh. Sorry, where am I? Kedis b'geres hakedush. Umishum zeh shayach behem hashini v'spoilos. That's where you have a level of divinity where it's possible to experience some kind of change because there's embodiment. It's an independent existence. However, ba'ira machaya, with the light, with the energy that allows this to be, in bishum shini v'spoilos. That doesn't change at all. Why? Lefisha eine misarev, because it doesn't mix. It doesn't mix. And because it doesn't mix, it's always separate. Take olive oil, pour it into water, mix it up, and come back a few hours later. What are you going to find? You're going to find it separate. It doesn't mix. You can't mix. You can't mix the olive oil in. It doesn't mix. Mix the light in. You can't mix the light. The light doesn't get adulterated by something else. If you put color into water, it was clear water, now it's blue water. The water is changed. I don't even think it's possible to make it clear again. Maybe you could. Maybe you can filter out the color. But it changes. But the light can never change. Kumesh Kosev, this is the meaning of what it says in Zohar. Ein Kodesh Kavaya. Nobody is as holy as God. You don't say. Nobody's as holy as God? What does it even mean? The Isa Bezoyer, the Zohar goes on, the Zohar says, Kama Kadish Aninon, there are lots of holiness. But less Kodesh Kavaya, but nothing's as holy as God. What does that even mean? It's mumbo jumbo. Everything's holy, lots of holy things, nothing's holy as God. Holiness means something that is separated, taken out of circulation. So an act of sacrilege is when you take something physical that was designated for a holy purpose and use it in a sacrilegious way. That's called sacrilege. Why? Because it's designated. And in Hebrew, to be makdish something means to dedicate it for this. It's a holy thing. So there are a lot of things which are designated, a lot of things which are separated from other things. But all of that separation, that's not separated the way God is separated. What does that mean? So he explains the meaning of the Zohar is that the kadishin of Seder Ishtashlos, when we talk about this perfectly designed order chain of descent in which we see the godliness relating to all the different levels as we've discussed. Hu shakadosh umuvdal. So there's a certain level that's beyond me. It's kadosh. It's impossible for me to grasp that. It's beyond my understanding. It's beyond my reach. The kedushasim husha'inim boyim bislapshus. How do you define the holiness? You define the holiness in that it can't be embodied. It can't be grasped. Avokashim islabshim, if you would be able to grasp it. That's it. Its holiness is in its non-graspability. But the moment you can grasp it, then it's no longer holy anymore. It's like saying something, this is the unknown. Why is it unknown? Because nobody knows it. And what if somebody figures it out? Now it's no longer unknown. It was unknown because it was its mystique was in its unknownness. It was separated. All these things are known and this is unknown. And then somebody discovered the answer. Now it's known. But godliness is ever unknown. It's inherently impossible to know God. Godliness is not lofty or holy because he is unknown. Our lack of knowledge of God doesn't make God great. They say, God is so great, I can't even know him. You don't define God. You can't define God dialectically by your lack of knowledge. So the kiddushin of Seder Shtal Shalos, you can define like that. Avakashim islabshim, when there is a islabshus, when there is an embodiment, if it becomes known, then it's no longer like that. Because b'chinas tfisa, then it's grasped. V'tfisa, once it's grasped, poel shinui. That's the nature. That's the nature of tfisa. Once you have a tfisa, once you have a grasp of it, then it's stuck in that reality. And it can't transcend that reality. When we talk about the holiness of God, you can't compare it to every other kind of holiness. But who? And that is, it cannot be embodied. And even if it were, so to speak, to be embodied, it's not really grasped. And it's not because it's not mixing. And this is, what does that mean? It sounds like mumbo jumbo, but Chassidus explains. Let's talk about photons. Light. When light filters through a certain color, does the light change? No. When the water has color introduced to it, the water does change. When you introduce a color into the light, you still didn't change the light. You can't introduce color into light. You can merely have light filter through a color. But the light never changes. Huh? Yes. Doesn't mix. So for example, here's a simple metaphor. You have light, say sunlight, white light, and it's going through a glass, a colored glass. There's a red glass, there's a yiruka, there's a green glass, there's a lavana, a white glass, various colors, which by the way, that Rebbe points out, represent the three emotions of chesed, gvura, teferet. But that's, we'll leave that for now. So the yesh chilukim b'maraselu. You look at. I mean, you have a red light, a red diffuser, and a blue diffuser, a green diffuser. You have green light and blue light, and white light. But the truth is, you are seeing light through a certain color. Inherently, there's no difference if you wear green sunglasses, or if there is a green diffuser around the light. In both cases, the light didn't change. You didn't offend the light, so to speak. You didn't adulterate the light. Ha'oyer hareu poshet u bilti yesh boi mara. It doesn't have a color. Klal mimara seschuches. It's in no way affected by the external glass that it passes through. Lefishu rak shemeir al yodeh. It's just, that's how the diffusion comes, that's all. A colored water jug is just the filter of the light. Yes, Darth, that is correct. That's exactly so. So it's again a metaphor of light. And even if it comes into what we call some kind of embodiment, I mean, the light's green after all. Look at this room. The whole room is lit up green. It's a neon green room because we got neon green diffusion. It must be in the 60s. So he says, it looks like a slabshus. However, it's not really grasped. The light can be red, the light can be blue, the light isn't changed. You never changed anything. Fsheni Misarov, because it doesn't mix. Well, Kamoy can you venderech dugma. Another paradigm of this would be, Ba'ur v'chayi saliki, with the vitality, the energy of God, Sheini Mishtana Klal, God isn't changed by creation. He's not limited. Oh, God's already doing all these things, he doesn't have time for me. He's too busy being involved with other things. In Bishum is spoilers for Shinoi. It can't affect God in any way. God is so much, it's beyond imagination, the greatness of God. So this is the secret of the light. The secret of the light is that the light is infinite. And even when the light's engaged, if you will, or creating all of the different variegation of existence, with trillions and trillions and trillions of details, the light is ever infinite and unfazed and unchanged. That's the secret of the light. Even when it's engaged, so to speak, it's still not really engaged because it's never grasped and God doesn't get busy. It goes to all levels. The furthest reach, so to speak, it's a euphemism. The lowest level. Like the lowest creatures. Wherever the light is, it doesn't in any way react. Because it's not limited. It doesn't change. Because it's inherently non-definable. Inherently beyond definition. That's why there can be such variegation. And that's why our universe is filled with such differentiation. Belishir, it's like unbelievable. Creation, the cosmos, is so vast. So many differences, so many nuances. It's mamash bligvul. It's like it's infinite. And the zehu, this is the meaning of, and this is what the Rebbe comes to explain in this maimer, that Eirin Seif is l'may l'may l'adin ketz, the loftiest, the highest of the high, and the l'may l'vizel l'mata mata adin tachlis. It goes down to the lowest of levels. Shehu b'hispashtus u'begili ad b'madrega ha'yosesh falim v'tachlis, till it comes down to the lowest of levels. So this is the meaning. Now I'll ask you a question. Here we are an hour and a bit later. Now let's sing that same song. Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere. After learning Chassidus for an hour, it's a different Hashem is here, Hashem is there. And it's all about understanding the secret of the light. And understanding about God helps us to have the proper relationship with Hashem, and it helps us to deepen our passion and our fervor for our worship and our service of Hashem in making our world the beautiful place that it is destined to and will be'ezrat Hashem soon be with the coming of Mashiach Tzidkenu. Thank you very much for joining. Thank you guys for being here. Shkoyach. And thank you all for being here online. Please like, please share, please subscribe, and do all those other good things. And may we meet soon in the third Beis HaMikdash, where the light will be available for us all to see. Thank you. To be continued.